Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We are wrestling, of course, with multiple challenges at the moment to that country we love, some external to it, some internal to it. Many of them are complex. Some of them are highly dynamic. All of them warrant our close attention, and we're delighted to have you with us as we try to apply the best thinking I know of to all of them. A lot of that resides in the brain of the man we're going to speak to first in this segment. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He is a contributor to a terrific online resource, The Federalist. He is a fellow of the Claremont Institute, one of its Publius fellows. He has been, I think, one of the most remarkable, relatively young contributors to the public policy debate on a whole host of issues, and it's always a privilege to be able to pick his brains a bit. Welcome back, Ben. It's good to have you with us at Securing America.
Thanks for having me, Frank. It's always my pleasure.
Let me start by asking you about a recent, cri de coeur, I guess is what the French might call it, obviously anguished appeal for a course correction to America's policy vis-a-vis China by a man who formally helped make it for the Trump administration. His name is Matthew Pottinger. He finished up in the Trump years as the Deputy National Security Advisor to the president. What did you make of his essay, and more to the point, his call for a course correction on China?
Well, I think it's a vital essay and important to keep in mind what Pottinger's role was in the Trump administration, which was to essentially help build a series of, and collectively, a comprehensive counter-CCP policy, which was rooted in some very simple principles. First of all, obviously understanding that China has been engaged in economic warfare and a slew of other warfares against America for decades, that American policy in effect aided, abetted, and enabled it, and that any comprehensive response, first of all, ought to start with reciprocity. So if they're going to have Confucius Institutes, we better have Jeffersonian Institutes there. And if not, those Confucius Institutes better be gone. Same thing with regards to a whole slew of other elements of the information warfare basket and beyond. And that really we have to look at them with clear eyes, understanding their comprehensive strategy to undermine us in a whole slew of areas and use our greed, naivete, and ignorance in many cases against us. Fast forward to where we are now, and this was very clear from the start with the Biden administration, starting from the principle, a question I asked, you asked, and many others asked, which is, what did Joe know, when did he know it, and what did he do about it with respect to his family's own dealings with communist China? Any analysis of the Biden administration's China policy has to start with the Biden family's direct potential compromise, at very, very minimum, appearance of a massive conflict with respect to the CCP, of course, in the commercial area. So in some cases, in some ways, this is a microcosm of the broader problem America has faced for 50 years now with respect to China, of commerce corrupting us and aiding, abetting, and enabling their efforts. And it starts from the principle, but it trickles down to many of the principles in this administration, which is they themselves have been contributors to the problem of growing deep, inextricable ties with communist China, or at very minimum, the very sort of globalist, let's deal with an international coalition to sort of counter China at the margins, but not really. It's an effort which, at best, you could say it's inconsistent across the board. And it's very clear that the administration has accepted many of the very premises that China uses against us and continues to want to have a booming relationship with communist China, which, how can you have that kind of relationship when they want to dominate you? They want to be the hegemonic world power.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it, Ben? It's having a booming relationship with communist China on its terms, which essentially means our subordination, if not our destruction, ultimately. And this is what's so frightening about what the Biden team is doing. You use the operative word. I think greed is certainly a, at play in connection with the Biden crime family, as it's been called, and quite possibly with respect to a number of the other principals of this administration subordinate to him. This brings me to a product that we've recently pushed out at the Center for Security Policy, Ben. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it or take it aboard, but it talks about all of this behavior towards China, this submission, this engagement, this capitulation, basically, against the backdrop of what our Team B3 has described as a biological warfare attack against America. Indeed, that, well, as our report says, the CCP is at war with America. It's hard to get your head around the idea that even in the midst of this kind of, well, people's war, they've called it unrestricted warfare, asymmetric warfare, biological warfare, we would still have people, whether in government or Larry Fink and people like him at BlackRock and other financial outlets. We'll be talking more about this with Bill Walton shortly, but this really does seem to me to be treasonous. Your thoughts?
Well, and it's worth noting a couple things with respect to the coronavirus pandemic. There are two elements of the assault on America vis-a-vis China. The first is whether or not, and it doesn't really matter, frankly, it does to some extent in terms of the nefarious and evil nature of the regime, but whether it was a bio accident or a conscious effort to unleash something on the world, and we don't know, is frankly, at least our intelligence services certainly have not given us a clear answer on this, even though they seem to be very confident that it wasn't a conscious attack. The way that China responded after the genie was out of the bottle, so to speak, made it clear they were going to exploit a biological attack in effect on the world. But then there's the other leg of it, which is the response to it. And it's not just, of course, China allowing Chinese nationals to go abroad in the wake and the cover-up and all of the various legs of the bio aspect of this. But then it's also the shutdowns, the lockdowns everywhere, which was a conscious Chinese decision to advocate for that globally and, of course, influence the global health institutions, which parroted the Chinese line, which led to cataclysmic disasters that will have generational consequences for the U.S. and the rest of the world, and to put a cherry on top, that we have never held China to account to it, which is, I think, of course, one of the top reasons probably why they were so pleased to see Donald Trump toppled, and the Chinese coronavirus, of course, contributed to that entire effort. So one aspect is the bio part, and the other aspect is leading us to commit some kind of self-righteous suicide, I guess, in the wake of it by following their disastrous panopticon, civilization-destroying policy of lockdowns ad nauseum.
Yeah, the China model, as it's been called. Ben, let me switch gears, and we're going to have to take a short break here in a moment, but just to tee up the idea, you have written at Newsweek a piece about an aspect of the China model, which is the control of information. In fact, the use of instruments of the state to censor, to suppress, to cancel even, sometimes more directly and sometimes through cutouts, like the big tech giants who are only too happy to help a like-minded administration in these regards, whether it's with respect to the vaccines, the vaccine mandates, the vaccine passports, or a whole host of issues that have nothing to do with the pandemic at all. This has been part of the purpose of this administration. When we come back, I want to talk about your piece in Newsweek about how the Disinformation Governance Board 2.0 is about to be rolled out. That and more with Ben Weingarten right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There's a Chinese communist product that is as addictive as its fentanyl, and potentially far more deadly.
The CCP's TikTok app has deeply penetrated the youth culture here, and according to, among others, a member of the Federal Communications Commission, it's a threat to the national security. The idea that a platform for sharing silly dance videos could be so dangerous is unimaginable to most of the kids hooked on it. Yet, the Chinese Communist's ability to exploit immense amounts of personal data about its users puts them at risk of manipulation, compromise, or worse. Incredibly, the U.S. military has decided to use the TikTok app to help address its serious recruiting shortfalls. What could possibly go wrong? The Chinese Communists would never allow us to operate a comparable app in their country, and we shouldn't let them do it here. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are continuing to converse with one of the brightest young men I know. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He is a contributor to The Federalist, also to Newsweek, and a very important senior fellow at the Claremont Institute's programs out there in California that have spawned the Publius Fellows and so much more. Ben, let me ask you about the prospect that we had a bit of a stay of execution, I guess the lawyers might say, not a commutation of sentence on this disinformation governance board, as it was called at the Department of Homeland Security. At Newsweek, you've written that they're back. Tell us what's coming next.
Well, a couple of things are really important to state at the outset about the so-called DGB, Disinformation Governance Board. First of all, the board was paused. It was not abolished by this administration. Second of all, it's being reviewed by a couple establishment, longtime DC intelligence community officials who are doing the review that will likely ultimately lead to its recasting. Third of all, the White House press secretary has said that our work continues with respect to combating disinformation. And the context for the DGB needs to be put in place. Yes, it was a ministry of truth. Yes, it was domestic focused, contrary to what Secretary Mayorkas of DHS said. And yes, it was clearly chilling the fact that this organ would be housed in a domestic agency focusing on domestic issues, despite what they said, as these whistleblower documents that we'll talk about, I assume, in a moment. Yeah. Note.
Domestic law enforcement agency, to be precise.
Domestic law enforcement, domestic narrative enforcement agency is what the DGB was established to do. But for months and months, really from the beginning of this administration, it has been focused on combating so-called misinformation and disinformation that saps confidence or faith in our democratic institutions, so-called. And it's codified in a document that I've pointed to again and again that I urge your viewers to check out, the Biden administration's National Strategy for Countering Domestic Terrorism. It makes it a national security imperative to combat misinformation and disinformation, i.e. information the administration does not like because it challenges its narratives in a whole slew of areas. And the administration has gone out and used the bully pulpit and very openly and honestly called on social media platforms to silence people when people put out actually narratives that the administration ends up adopting 6 months later when it comes to the coronavirus, for example. So they've been very open and honest about this. Their threat bulletins that they've put out put so-called misinformation and disinformation as drivers of the greatest national security threats to our country. So this has to be seen as of a piece and just one aspect of a much broader war on wrongthink that the administration has been engaged on that I've been chronicling from the outset.
Yeah. Ben, no, you've been doing terrific work on all of this. I did want to ask you about something that I'm picking up is now the newest of the domestic threats that the administration would have us believe endanger our country, whether it's exactly terrorism or something else, I'm not quite sure yet, but it sounds as though it's going to head into that general direction. And that is something that they're describing as Christian nationalism. What exactly is that about? And who do they have in mind pillorying or worse next?
Well, probably your viewers, but they were probably already under the microscope, quite frankly. I think when it comes to this notion of these various so-called extremist groups that the administration focuses on, of course, never on the left, it's important to keep in mind that their whole focus is defending our democracy, so-called. And what they use our democracy as a stand-in for, or as a euphemism for, ruling class domination, its ability to impose its will and drive every single aspect of society towards its desired ends of perpetuating its power, privilege, and prerogatives over us. So when
at the expense of the personal freedoms of everybody else.
Of course, it's antithetical to the American system. Of course, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. It's anti-democratic and anti-republican, obviously. And essentially, this whole war on wrongthink is about controlling the narrative to control power. And so they cast anyone who dares take a position that's at odds with the prevailing progressive globalist internationalist kind of position. They cast those ideas themselves as dangerous, those who hold those ideas as themselves dangerous to society, and then use the national security apparatus as well as private sector entities to target them precisely so that they can cause people to be chilled, silenced, and to back off and to not challenge them. That's precisely why we have to use our liberties to challenge them and speak openly and honestly about it. Contrary to what they would claim, not in a violent sort of extent, but in terms of information and in terms of speaking truth, which they claim to do, but they don't.
You do, Ben, and we're so grateful to you for it and for your sharing those insights with us in your own right. I'd also like you to talk a little bit about a really important piece that your colleague at The Federalist, Molly Hemingway, has written about another line of attack, if you will, by the Biden team. Similar purpose, I suppose, but a election domineering sort of strategy at the federal level. We're hearing a little bit about how the Supreme Court is going to take up in its docket next session a case about, you know, election integrity and the role of states and so on. Give us a quick backgrounder, if you would, on what the administration has up its sleeve in this regard and Molly's warnings about it.
Well, this is sort of like Zuckerbucks, but at the federal level, using the entirety of the administrative state. The administration has put out an executive order, which essentially empowers and directs a whole slew of agencies. I think Molly claims something like 600 different entities of the federal government to go out and push swelling the voter rolls, essentially. At least that's putatively what this is about. We don't know precisely who the federal government is partnering with in this regard, but you can bet it's probably going to be progressive groups if past is prologue. We don't know what precisely federal officials are directing state and local entities to be doing here. And that's because they're not being at all transparent about it. And that's the starting premise of Molly's exceptional piece, which is the administration's not being transparent about what the federal government is doing, what the executive branch is doing here. Just like with Zuckerbucks, except in some ways, maybe that's even worse because that's a private entity. I don't know. We're picking our poison here. But the fact of the matter is, this goes to your point about federalizing elections as opposed to having a federalist system. And let's not forget that the first piece of legislation out of this house was H.R. 1, the so-called For the People Act, which was anything but, which is all about federal control over elections instead of state and local authorities having sovereignty over them. And to your point, that will come up in the next Supreme Court. It's vital that the Supreme Court rules rightly in that regard. States are laboratories of experiment. They control the elections, not the feds.
Well, we can only pray at this point that the Supreme Court's rulings, whatever they might be on this matter, are actually going to be adhered to by the federal government. It seems increasingly problematic as the administration, notably in the Roe versus Wade ruling of Dobbs, seems to be deciding whether it's going to be burdened by whatever the court has decided or not. It certainly will be working overtime using elections most powerfully to try to overturn that ruling, and maybe the court being packed itself. a lot more to talk with you about on all of these counts. Ben Weingarten, thank you for what you do. How do people follow you most easily?
Yep, you can follow me on Twitter at BH Weingarten, or the best place is subscribe to my Substack, where I send out all my latest writings and commentary. That's weingarten.substack.com.
Terrific. You are a man to be followed, that's for sure. We try to as often as possible here, including in person whenever possible. And I hope that you'll make a repeat appearance in the very near future, my friend. In the meantime, stay well and keep up the terrific work you do at the Federalists and elsewhere. Next up, we're going to speak with Bill Walton. We'll talk about some of these same issues with him, particularly the China matter and our underwriting of the danger it poses to all of us. That and more, straight ahead.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is one of our regulars here at Securing America. His name is Bill Walton. He is a recovering master of the universe on Wall Street at Allied Capital. He has been a leader of a really important conservative movement organization, of which I'm proud to be a member, the Council for National Policy. And now he is the host of a terrific television podcast program called The Bill Walton Show. I commend it to all of you. Bill, it's good to have you with us as always. Welcome back. I hope you had a good 4th of July, sir.
Frank, we're back at it.
In the trenches, as always. Bill, I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things, but let me start with something we touched on with Ben Weingarten earlier, just to get your take on it. You're a member of our Committee on the Present Danger China, a good friend of our Center for Security Policy, which have partnered up to produce what we call our Team B3 report, an exercise in competitive analysis about the Director of National Intelligence's seemingly seriously flawed assessment last fall about the origins of the virus, the pandemic that has caused us so much harm over the past 2 years. The Team B report concluded that that was in fact a virus that emanated from a laboratory, a biological warfare laboratory, and that the dissemination by the Chinese, the purposeful dissemination of it via pushing people out of Wuhan into international airports all across the world, was a biological warfare attack. I'd be interested in your take on the report and its finding that, well, as the report is called, the CCP is at war with America.
Well, let's start with the fact that, as usual, nothing with China, with regard to China, is a two-way street. I mean, while we're completely open to Chinese infiltration at all levels of government and in our businesses and in universities. They seem to know everything that's going on here. When this outbreak occurred, we were not allowed into China, and there was a complete shutdown of information flowing out of China, and a lot of smoke and mirrors about whether they're locking down, not locking down. Of course, they also canceled flights inside China, but then conveniently let you fly to San Francisco or Northern Italy or Switzerland or your destination, your virus destination of your choice. And, you know, to you and to me and a lot of other people who understand what China's about, this looks suspicious from day one. Well, what your team has done, and I highly recommend going to securefreedom.org for the webinar. We've got all the interviews up there. It's now clear this virus does look to be highly engineered. It does look to be something that was deliberately let loose. And there are just all sorts of entities out there that want to keep this covered up. First, there's the embarrassment factor about how we didn't see this early on, this threat to our country, and the fact that we, you know, strategically didn't assess that China is at war with us, and this is just one of their chosen forms of warfare.
It is indeed unrestricted warfare. Biological warfare was one of the techniques that was itemized back in 1999.
And you can go and read about all this. I mean, this part of China is visible to us. You know, they write about what their plans are. This is part of it.
But one of the interesting critiques of all of this by the co-chairman of the Team B, namely Pete Hoekstra, on the air last week, he talked about the fact that this whole biological warfare capability of China, illegal, by the way, just didn't seem to be much interest to the intelligence community of the United States. So even the open source stuff seemingly has just not gotten the attention it deserves. And I would add to your litany there, Bill, of reasons why we haven't gotten this right is, of course, it turns out Tony Fauci was helping to pay for and provide technology to the biological warfare program of the Chinese Communist Party, specifically the so-called gain of function research. This is a scandal of the first order, and I appreciate your appreciation of the Team B report, and I join you in commending it to all of our listeners. Again, you can find the book at CCP is at war with America. .com. Bill, let me turn to a related topic about the war that the Chinese Communist Party has been waging, well, against America, yes, but against the free world more generally. Last week, we marked the 25th anniversary of the surrender of Hong Kong to China. I know in your business career, you've been there, you've worked with people in Hong Kong extensively, I'm sure. You know what that city was when it was under the rule of law, the British territory initially, and then what's become of it since the Chinese crushed freedom there. Your thoughts?
Well, it for anybody who's paid attention to what happened there, it's just absolutely heartbreaking. China took over what was considered a real symbol of freedom in Asia, Hong Kong. Had been a British colony, and then Brits pretty much let them set up as an independent entity, and they were just an incredible hub of financial activity, technological manufacturing, and freedom. They had free press, and they had all the things that you associate with a healthy society. Well, China cut a deal in 1997, and you probably know more about the details of that, Frank. But since then, they've just slowly enveloped Hong Kong so that now it's no longer even remotely free. It's just back practically part of the rest of China. And they've gone so far, the Chinese Communist Party has gone so far, the high school textbooks in Hong Kong now won't tell you that it was once a British colony. That's been erased from history. So we've got the Orwellian rewriting of history, which is going on today, right now, if you're in a Chinese or a Hong Kong high school.
A classic Chinese communist play, you know, history is rewritten, people are removed from photographs and the like. Bill, I was there, as I think you know, for the surrender. And as I talked about last week with Claudia Rosette, it was one of the most depressing days of my life, seeing what we were doing to those people who aspired to have freedom and struggled for it, even after they were abandoned. And you know, Bill, tying back to the previous conversation, what made it possible in the end for the Chinese to take down Hong Kong without mass bloodshed was the virus. They locked everybody down and they were unable to demonstrate. They were unable to exert any counter pressure to what the Chinese were up to, and the national security law and so on simply vaporized what was left of freedom decades before the Chinese promised to do that.
The Chinese epitomized the phrase, don't never let a crisis go to waste. I mean, absolutely. They seized on the lockdowns in Hong Kong to wring every last drop of freedom out of that colony, and the Orwellian. I mentioned Orwell. The I'm running out of ways to describe it, but you've got Xi, President Xi, going there to celebrate 25 years of independence, supposedly, and acting as if it were still a free colony, and not even remotely saying, you know, admitting that they've just tucked it neatly into the Chinese Communist Party.
Just another Chinese communist city. You know, he actually had the gall to say that the one country, two systems model was still being applied, and clearly it's not. All in the course of installing one of their thugs as the new head of the Legislative Council.
Not that there's a direct parallel here, but Frank, you know, they've taken down all the statues. And they had something called the Pillar of Shame in the on the campus of Hong Kong University. That's gone. They were trying to find another spot for it, to send it off to the victims of Tiananmen Square. But no shipping company was willing to undertake the job. Now, if you remember, Elaine Chao's family owns a shipping company in China. I'm surprised they didn't want to take that on.
Very interesting point. Elaine Chao, of course, being the former labor secretary, among other things, and the wife of the minority leader of the United States Senate, deeply compromised, as is her husband, I fear. Bill, let me turn to another line of attack, if you will, in the unrestricted warfare that the Chinese are engaged in. We're going to have to take a break here in a minute, but just to tee this up. TikTok is a Chinese app that has become wildly addictive, I think it's fair to say, among young people, particularly in this country. It's best known for these crazy short dance videos that are, you know, amusing. And I'm told that kids are spending on average 46 minutes a day taking aboard the TikTok content. What they're doing in the process is providing TikTok with a lot of personal data. This has actually been described, this app, as a national security threat by, among others, most recently, Brendan Carr, I believe it is, a commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. Quickly, 30 seconds on TikTok, and we'll come back to it on the other side of a short break.
Well, the first thing we need to understand is TikTok is basically the Chinese Communist Party. And in 2018, the CEO of TikTok knuckled under the CCP and said that socialist core values and devotion to the Chinese Communist Party were an essential part of the TikTok mission.
And just part of the mission, just doing their job. And that is the point. They're just another Chinese company doing what the Chinese Communist Party tells them to do. Bill, I want to come back to this. We're going to speak about a guy who, an American, who is lying about TikTok and what we might expect in that department and more with Bill Walton right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. there's a Chinese communist product that is as addictive as its fentanyl, and potentially far more deadly. The CCP's TikTok app has deeply penetrated the youth culture here, and according to, among others, a member of the Federal Communications Commission, it's a threat to the national security. The idea that a platform for sharing silly dance videos could be so dangerous is unimaginable to most of the kids hooked on it. Yet, the Chinese Communist's ability to exploit immense amounts of personal data about its users puts them at risk of manipulation, compromise, or worse. Incredibly, the U.S. military has decided to use the TikTok app to help address its serious recruiting shortfalls. What could possibly go wrong? The Chinese Communists would never allow us to operate a comparable app in their country, and we shouldn't let them do it here. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Bill Walton is in the house virtually. We're always delighted to have him with us. We're talking about China in various respects, especially with regard to the unrestricted warfare that it is waging against the United States. So we talked before the break briefly, Bill, about TikTok, an unlikely instrument of, well, information warfare, hoovering up immense amounts of personal data from kids who are innocently taking aboard their dance videos and the like there. There's a fellow by the name of Michael Beckerman, who CNN reports is the head of Public Policy Americas at TikTok. And he said that it is simply false, quote unquote, simply false, that TikTok is collecting browser history. And he said, when asked about whether the Chinese Communist Party members have had access to non-public TikTok user data, quote, "The answer is we have never shared information with the Chinese government, nor would we," unquote. Now, I ask you, Bill, there's something called civil-military fusion, which is a prime doctrine of the Chinese Communist Party. There are national intelligence laws. There are national security laws. There's all kinds of arrangements, including usually having minders either on the board or simply seated next to the people running these companies who are Chinese Communist Party members and, you know, informants and, more to the point, political commissars, I guess you might say. Is there a snowball's chance in Hades that the Chinese Communist Party does not have access to whatever it wants from TikTok, including user data, personal private user data from all of these American kids?
I think the odds are about where you put them. You know, I, just for fun, I've reached that stage of life. I'm finally getting around reading Dante's Divine Comedy and the Inferno part. I think Mr. Beckerman probably deserves a special place there for mendacity. I mean, the idea that these people think they can say things like this with a straight face and expect people to believe them. Of course, they're actually following the lead of their president, Biden, in saying bald-faced things. But no, there's not a chance that isn't happening. But the other thing besides collecting personal data, Frank, is the pernicious influence of the TikTok app on everything, on behavior. And I mentioned at the outset that TikTok is embedded in its culture, interested in promoting Chinese communist values and people getting people thinking in the way that the Chinese Communist Party wants them to think. It's not possible that that's not also part of what the TikTok apps are that in here in the United States.
And absolutely,
there was an article.
And it's an instrument of unrestricted warfare against our country.
It is not possible. And, you know, the social media world, I'm beginning to think, has done an infinite amount of damage, and particularly to our children. And it's not, you know, so we've got some innocent apps mainly mainly here in the United States, I think. I'm not sure. But you take a look at TikTok and you say, why would we want to take the chance to have them be here, influence our kids?
Right. Well, you know, it's been noted in a lot of places that most of these social media mavens in the United States won't let their kids have access to whatever it is they're pushing, you know, with the various products. And all of them, let's face it, as they say, if you're not paying for a service, you're giving them your data, which is their form of compensation. And what they do with it, in some cases with the Chinese, is something we can only speculate about. Hey, Bill, I wanted to turn to one other thing. As I mentioned, you've hailed from Wall Street. BlackRock is the 800-ton gorilla on Wall Street. And what's becoming more and more apparent by the day is Larry Fink, the CEO of that enterprise, not only has power beyond almost imagining and no accountability, which I think makes him a very dangerous man indeed, with his environment, social, and governance agenda on the one hand, and his enormous commitment to enriching the Chinese Communist Party on the other. But he's not the only BlackRock executive or alumnus who is engaged in promoting the interests of China, it seems. What can you tell us about Tom Donilon and Brian Deese and Wally Adeyemo, three guys who just happened to be fixtures at BlackRock or previously were, who are now in very key positions in the Biden administration?
Well, I think the thing to key to understanding Tom Donilon, he's a political operative that's been around for decades and, you know, worked, I think, first, he may have gone all the way back to Carter, but he also worked for the Clintons, and he's been a fixer and an operative in the Democratic miasma forever. And he carries all that baggage with him. And now he's repositioned himself as a strategic national security advisor. And he heads up a group inside BlackRock that provides strategic advice to BlackRock about national security or foreign relations matters. I don't remember the exact euphemism they give it, but you know, it's incredibly useful for a hedge fund or a big money manager to have ties inside of a government to know exactly what the government's going to do. There are a lot of ways to make money if you know what government actions are going to be coming about. You know, famously, George Soros broke the Bank of England at one point, but he did it with inside information from the Bank of England, or so the reports go. I mean, I tend to believe them. We found a smoking gun, but we really didn't find the fingerprints on it exactly. He's too smart for that. Anyway, my point is Donilon's all part of that, the Fink intelligence machine, and he's one of, I think, probably in influence operations. He's probably one of five or six people operating inside the White House now, and it's hard to know where the White House begins and black.
No good can come of it, though. I think we can say that for sure. Bill, we have to leave it at that. I'm afraid we are hard out of time. I just wanted to say that in this, I know so much more. Come back for another week. In this Epoch Times article, there's an interesting reference to a Kimberly Lang with whom Tom Donilon has met, and nobody can seem to figure out what exactly her job is at the White House. We'll be tracking that down. For sure. Bill, thank you for your time today. Come back to us next week. Peter Husey is up next, right after this. We're back. Peter Husey is in the house. Peter is one of the people in Washington who has been relentlessly paying attention to the sort of thing that most of the rest of us don't. frankly. Nuclear policy programs and their implications for national security, ours and others around the world. Peter is these days with the Hudson Institute and geostrategic analysis. He is the maven of countless events and breakfasts and lunches and dinners that bring people together to discuss these sorts of issues. And we owe him a great debt of gratitude for...
Thank you, Frank.
I think the culture that you have helped create to take on these really important issues. Peter, and it brings me to two topics that you have addressed recently at warriormaven.com. The fourth nuclear window of vulnerability is an important way to think about the era that we're now in. Tell us about the other three and what is unique about this.
Well, the first one was Eisenhower said, I don't want to spend a lot of money on defense, technically, so I'm going to have massive retaliation. And when Kennedy came in, he said, you know, threatening Armageddon if the Russians mess around with Taiwan or the Korea isn't credible. So we developed flexible response. And Jim Schlesinger, our former Secretary of Defense and CIA director, developed the ability to hit the other guys, not cities, but their weapons. And if you took away their weapons and they can't fight anymore, that's deterrence. You take away what they value. And that was the first window of vulnerability that was then solved by the Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon administrations. But then because of the SALT treaties allowed a huge buildup from 2,000 to 12,000 warheads by the Russians. We called it arms control anyway. The Russians, multiple warheads on their missiles, 99% of them were on alert any time, and they had a huge capability to take us out in a preemptive strike. And that was Reagan's window of vulnerability that he was worried about. And he said, you have to develop modernization, arms control, and by the way, get rid of the Soviet Union and resolve it, which he was successful in doing. And he put into motion an arms control deal that got 90% of the weapons that were in the deployed reduced, except for theater systems. And that brought the third window of vulnerability, which was this problem of what if they go small? Because you don't have missile defenses, and escalate to win was at a conventional level, you don't want to get involved, America, because we, Russia, have nuclear weapons and we'll use a limited number in the theater, which is what Ukraine is all about. And so we ended up with this new window of vulnerability, and we have gravity bombs on fighter planes in Europe, but that's it. We can't pick up hypersonic speed weapons at the theater level. We can't find them. We don't know where they're coming from, and we can't shoot them down. So that means missile defense and developing theater systems now is the fourth window, which we're challenged with. And as Admiral Richard, who's head of STRATCOM, says, we're facing two nuclear-armed peer competitors, China and Russia, for the first time in our history.
Yeah. Peer competitors may be understating the problem, in fact, if both their numbers of weapons exceed ours, and certainly the quality by virtue of the fact that they've been modernizing theirs aggressively, and we haven't been so much. Peter, talk a little bit about the degree to which we nonetheless, despite this record of having very consistently now for decades, essentially left our nuclear modernization programs on hold, a busman's holiday, some call it, we're hearing the arms controllers blaming America for the buildups that are taking place in Russia and China. It doesn't make any sense at all to me, but what's going on?
Well, I've been doing research on this, and it is Putin decided to build all these new weapons in 1997, 98, 99, when he was head of the Security Council in Russia. And he put into motion, depending on how you count, 28 to 30 new long-range strategic programs, all of which are now deployed at the 90% level. There are some left that he's still working on. And then he decided that, well, we need theater systems too, and they have dozens of these that are under no controls in arms control, because there's never been a treaty on this business, except for on missiles, which INF, but they're not, it doesn't deal with all the other nukes. So Putin basically decided, I'm going to go really big under the treaty environment I have, which enabled him to do so. And then China, in depending on when you, but sometime in the 2000s, 2010, decided to go big. And though they told us, oh, it's a peaceful rise, don't worry about us. And now my friend Jim Howe down in Huntsville has figured out the Chinese are building ICBM silos faster than we did under Kennedy and Johnson when we finished the Minuteman 1,000 more missile silos in 5 years. Okay, he just sent it to me yesterday.
And Peter, this is now producing something on the order of 350 of these silos, as I understand it, designed to hold missiles with as many as 10 warheads on them. So how is it that the arms controllers are saying that America is somehow responsible for what the Russians and Chinese have done, completely, obviously, independent of our restraint, actually?
They know they have no power over the Russian-Chinese system, so they got to blame us, because that's the only way they have any leverage in terms of politically. People aren't going to donate the money if they say, well, we're going to get China to change. No, you're not, because that's a road too far. But, oh, why, we can get America to change. We just get a new president, new secretary of state, new somebody. And the thing is, the procurement holiday we took in 1997, in 1992, 1995, 1997, we killed all elements of our strategic nuclear deterrent. Just stop building. Stop Peacekeeper, the Ohio-class sub, the D-5, and the B-2. And we didn't build anything new until 2029 will be the first nuclear-armed ICBM submarine or bomber that comes into force. So what the arms
controllers... Assuming that the arms controllers' friends in the Biden administration don't screw any of them up, which is a big uncertainty. Peter, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, for the moment, but we will be back to you soon for further information on this. But the main point is, blame America first, as our friend Gene Kirkpatrick used to say, is the reflexive default setting of a lot of these arms control guys. And it could very well get a lot of us killed. We can't stand that, that's for sure. Peter Husey, thank you for your time today. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Securing America. Come back to us again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, folks, go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.